So we are reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita. We're reading from the Madhya Lila. We're on chapter 6, verse 178, which makes up part of the conversations between Lord Chaitanya and Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. Bhagavana sambandha bhakti abhidhaya prema prayojana vede tina vashtukaya. Bhagavan sambandha bhakti abhidhaya prema prayojana vede tina vashtukaya. Bhagavan sambandha bhakti abhidhaya prema prayojana vede tina vashtukaya. Translation: Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued, "The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the central point of all relationships. Acting in devotional service to Him is one's real occupation, and the attainment of love of Godhead is the ultimate goal of life. These three subject matters are described in the Vedic literature." Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. In the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, Lord Krishna confirms this statement, "Vedischa saver aham eva vedyaha." The actual purpose in reading the Vedas is to learn how to become a devotee of the Supreme Lord. The Lord Himself advises, "Man mana bhava mad bhakto matyaji mam namaskuru." Bhagavad Gita chapter 9 verse 34. Therefore, after studying the Vedas, one must then execute devotional service by thinking always of the Supreme Lord, Manmana, becoming His devotee, worshipping Him, and always offering Him obeisances. This is called Vishnu Aradhana, and it is the supreme occupational duty of all human beings. It is properly discharged in the Varnashram Dharma system, which divides society into Brahmacharya, Grahastha, Vanaprastha and Sannyas, and Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra. This is the whole scheme of Vedic civilization. However, this institution is very difficult to establish in this age. Therefore, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advises that we not worry about the Vedic system of Varnashram Dharma. Rather, we should take directly to the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra and simply hear about the Supreme Personality of Godhead from pure devotees. This is the process recommended by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and this is the purpose for studying the Vedas. Please join me in singing Mangalarachanam prayers, even at home. This way we can invite the Acharyas and ask their permission for us to be able to not just say something, but for us, all of us together, to be able to understand. These classes are made by those who are hearing, those of you, even more so than the speaker, because everybody's consciousness has an impact on what is spoken about. Om Agyanta Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militamena Tasmay Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Vishnam Stapatamena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swavadatikam Mandeham Shri Guru Shri Yata Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sakrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitantam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sarvadutam Parijana Sitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrinda Vaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktivrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. I'm just going to repeat the verse one more time. Bhagavan Sambandha Bhakti Abhidayohaya Prema Prayojana Vedetina Vashtukaya. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu continued, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the central point of all relationships. Acting in devotional service to Him is one's real occupation. And the attainment of love of Godhead is the ultimate goal of life. These three subject matters are described in the Vedic literatures. So a considerable amount of time in this section of Chaitanya Charitamrita has been the conversation between Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Lord Chaitanya. Actually, Lord Chaitanya remains quiet for a significant period of time. You know, he lets Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya speak and speak and speak and speak. And then he systematically, as you've heard of the last few weeks, refutes the different arguments. Now, in this verse, this is this turning point. This is a turning point where Lord Chaitanya stops telling Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya what's wrong and what the corrections and the mistakes and errors are in his logic and conclusion, and actually says, you know, after having read everything, this is the conclusion of the Vedas. So if you read the entire body of the Vedas, this is the conclusion. And if after reading every Veda, every book, every philosophy, everything out there, you have not understood these three very clear points, okay, then you have simply just, it's like wasting your time. What is the point? This is the conclusion of the Vedas. And this is a very key verse for us, particularly as Vaishnavas. You know, Srila Prabhupada describes Chaitanya Charitamrita as postgraduate study. Because actually we can see from this conversation, it takes a long time for a jiva, for an individual to get to a point where we're even willing to accept that this is the goal of life. We get lost in the flowery words of the Vedas. We get lost in the other things that are on offer through the Vedas. Even when we look at the bhakti scriptures, right? Even when we hear that Krishna says one who performs devotional service is immediately endowed with all mystic siddhis, we can also get distracted by that. There's no suffering. One can get distracted by that. So actually these three statements, which actually we understand as sambandha, the why, you know, the why of our process, what is the hook? Ultimately, it's about our relationship with Krishna. This is the one, this is why we should be doing it. How do we execute this abhideya through the process of devotional service? And then what is the ultimate goal? Pure love for Krishna. You know, actually this why, how and what is the process and is the system for everything that has ever been pitched to us, sold to us. If anyone's trying to influence us in any way, and we do exactly the same thing. If we're going to be successful, people want to know why, how, and what. Even in science, hypothesis, method, and conclusion, right? Why, how, and what. So these are essential. And it's through the simple system of the why, how, and what that we determine where our life goes. We determine what goals we have. We determine how we live our life, because there's got to be a hook, a why, right? Something that attracts us, that makes us go, okay, I'm going to invest in this. And, you know, why is it that after having read and heard so much about the conclusion of the Vedas, why is it that we find that, okay, I have the perfect why? relationship with Krishna. This is what everybody's actually ultimately seeking. We are seeking relationship. Right? Why do we seek relationship? Because whether we like to accept it or not, whether we are open to it or not, relationship is where we experience most. Now, we can't make a statement that relationship is where we are most happy, but because relationships, especially here, can also cause us equal pain. But we experience. What does experience mean? We get to be. We get to interact. We get to experience ourselves as well, even if it's just the psychological self, even our role in this world. So relationship is the biggest hook. Okay. But one of the reasons it's the biggest hook is we are naturally designed, even if we don't have a spiritual understanding of this, even if we look around, everybody's looking for an effortless peak of pleasure. We often say we're all looking for happiness, but actually we're looking for that effortless peak of pleasure, right? And everything that is, every idea or any object or any service that's ever sold to us, whether that's through a TV or radio or on social media or an influencer, it is sold in this premise that this will give you an effortless peak of happiness. Right? And so we see pervading all over society commonly understood effortless peaks of happiness. What provides the most effortless peak of happiness? What's the most commonly understood universally? You know, it'll be some sort of psychoactive substance, drugs or alcohol, or it will be sex, because these two are quicker and shorter than engaging in a full-on relationship, which requires effort, where there's pain as well. There's sacrifice. So this why is really taken advantage of, the perverted reflection of this ultimate effortless, you know, high that we're looking for, which actually really, that effortless high is natural to us. This is what we talk about, bliss. The bliss of the Atma, the bliss of our true self, is an effortless high. And it's effortless because it fully manifests when we are in relationship with Krishna. So even having understood that, even having then heard what the process is of how to achieve that, and also having understood or at least heard about Prem, the goal, unconditional love, not just unconditional giving of love to Krishna, but actually receiving unconditional love from Krishna. And that's not that he suddenly starts loving us unconditionally. He always has, always will. He will never stop. But we start to experience that unconditional love. Not just start, but we continue, and not just continue, but it's ever increasing. Actually, if we read our Goswami's literatures, that unconditional loving exchange begins at Prem. It doesn't, Prem is a starting point. So after hearing so much, and Arjuna asks Krishna this question, after hearing so much, after knowing what the right thing to do is, why is it that I still do what isn't good, what isn't healthy, as if compelled by some unseen force? And Krishna very simply says, well, that's lust only. He goes on to explain where lust sits. Lust is sits in the mind and the heart. And what do we mean by the mind and the heart? We mean, the mind that isn't just local to the brain. The mind is pervasive. And by the heart, we don't mean, you know, we also understand Atma and Paramatma also in the heart. So we have the spiritual heart. There's also an emotional or psychological heart as well as the physical heart. So this emotional heart that we experience, we'd often talk about pain in the chest. It's linked with the fact that, you know, the mind, our Vedic understanding of the mind is that it's beyond the brain. Okay. And so there is a thinking aspect to the mind, which is very much facilitated by the brain. And there is an emotional and psychological aspect in terms of the feeling aspect, sorry, not the psychological, the feeling aspect because psychology means thoughts and feelings. So thoughts come from the brain, and feelings we experience, or at least physically, if we were to locate them, we would point here, right? When you say, I think, we put our hand here. And when I say, I feel, I put my hand here. So there's definitely this kind of non-local to the brain experience of the mind. Actually, psychology doesn't in itself mean thoughts and feelings. If we look at the term psychiatry or psychology or psychotherapy, this word psych, actually it's a Greek word, and it actually means soul, it actually means spirit. So really, actually, the conclusion of, and Prabhupada says this elsewhere, that actually real psychology or psychiatry looks at removing this illusion or delusion that we are these bodies. So this lust, the resting place of the mind and the heart, why is it then that we are more strongly influenced by the pulls of this lust? By the pulls of this, what is lust? Lust is... sense gratification in any shape or form. What do we mean by sense gratification? That's that pursuit of that, like I was, that phrase, the effortless peak of happiness, isn't it? Whether it's for a new car, a new watch, a new relationship, some status in society, a new position, a new role, our appearance, whatever it is, we are lusting after it because it is a perverted reflection of love, in that it appears to give us an effortless peak of happiness, but the down after that peak of happiness is very down, and the peak of happiness is actually a shadow of the real peak of happiness. So why does this happen? Now, Krishna spends a lot of time in the Bhagavad Gita explaining to us about the mind and how the mind is very difficult to control. And the mind can be distracted by even one sense. Mind is really like a mirror, but whatever is shown on the mind, whatever the mind is exposed to, the mind reflects, the mind processes, we feel it, we meditate on it, we develop a will and attachment for it, and then we pursue it, okay? And the mind can equally face outwards, and it can equally face inwards, the bridge of the mind. So we understand the mind can be our worst enemy and our best friend. But if we just look at the mind itself in terms of the way it functions, and we look at everything around us, you know, we are living in a world where actually it doesn't matter if you are in India, in Africa, in the UK, in America, in Europe. Okay. Now it seems that whether you're in a developed country or a developing country, whether you're rich or poor, you have access to digital content in some shape or form, either through a tablet, a laptop, television, phone. But I say television because televisions are digital now. Gone are the days of having to tune your TV with the dial on the phone. And digital content is very rapid, bypasses a lot of our discrimination, makes it very hard for us to switch off because it keeps us engaged in this why, how, what constantly. Monitors our patterns. So it is like a drug peddler, right? A drug dealer. A drug dealer keeps their business going by giving away freebies all the time, right? They create new drug users. They know that if they charge everybody money straight away, many people can't afford the drug, or their own discrimination would get in the way. So what they do is they give freebies. They get young people, old people, all sorts of people, anybody who seems like they're vulnerable, looking for that effortless happiness, or looking to get away from misery, or simply they just want to create a business. They look for someone. They give them a freebie. They get them hooked on the why, how, and what. And the addictive cycle begins, where then that person loses their discrimination. Their attachment or addiction to the drug then supersedes even their ability to afford it. And then we have a business, full-blown business for that drug dealer. And somebody who is now feeling like they've lost control of their ability to choose when to seek out that effortless high. So why am I comparing this to digital media? Now, the drug peddler can't predict when somebody needs something. There's always a risk that the person might find help, they might wake up, come to their senses, or something else of more value to them trumps the meaning of the drugs, right? Plenty of people would say they've tried drugs and not become addicted. Not every single person who tries drugs becomes addicted. But what happens with digital media is because everything that we're doing is watched very closely, our patterns, our desires, our likes are not just being predicted, they're also being molded. Now, I don't want to turn this into a Bhagavatam class about digital media, but what I'm highlighting is in today's world, our ability to give the mind some space to turn inwards, to absorb and digest what we've read, what we've heard, to apply what we've read and what we've heard is becoming increasingly difficult. Because we're finding less and less time to switch it off from the outside world, switch it off from the false ego, switch it off from, you know, what Prabhupada calls even our temporary occupational duties, because they are temporary and transient. Our role in this world is temporary and transient, no matter how exalted that role might be. It's temporary and transient. So what is it? This outside noise, everything we're exposing ourselves to, all these many whys, hows, and whats, why you should have this next new thing, how you can get it and what you're going to get from it, why you should have it, what are you missing in your life, right? All of these things create our mental dialogue. Now, if 24 hours of the day and we're spending less and less time sleeping, and then that, sadly, that's not because we are spending more and more time chanting and reading. We're spending less and less time sleeping because, especially if we are using digital media, even if it's for work, people are finding that they're on that digital media till much later in the night. Like if somebody said to you, go to work till 11 o'clock at night, before this digital media came, you'd scoff at them. You'd go, what are you talking about? I'm not going to work till 11 o'clock at night. Now it's quite common for people to say, oh, yeah, I'll check my work emails at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Even service, right? If somebody told you regularly on a daily basis, do your service at 11 o'clock at midnight. Now, unless it's a specific service that you're supposed to do at 11 o'clock at midnight, you'd say, no, we're trying to create a lifestyle here in the temple where we're able to go to bed early and rise at, 3:30 a.m. and be ready for Mangala Arati. But now, just ask yourselves, how common is it for you to be there at 10 o'clock at night, 10:30 on your phone, maybe responding to a service request or arranging something for later? Or even waking up in the morning, somebody said to you, start your service from the moment you open your eyes. Yes, we understand internally we want to start our service to Krishna, but you wouldn't just jump on the altar as soon as you opened your eyes. There'd be a process to gather yourself, right? You wouldn't just roll out of bed and go and give Bhagavatam class. You wouldn't roll out of bed. Do you see what I mean? You wouldn't even roll out of bed and go to work. There's this time for preparation. But with this digital media, the moment you wake up and the alarm's used as an excuse, okay, oh, here we go. I'm going to, engage again. So this time to switch off, and sleep doesn't necessarily mean that we're switching off, because very much what we're doing in the day comes in our sleep. If we're absorbed in Krishna during the day, our sleep will be absorbed in Krishna as well. If during the day, in 24 hours, we're spending 18 hours absorbed on a gazillion other things outside of what's important, that's what we'll dream about and that's what we'll wake up thinking about. So this mind is, we are struggling, even as Vaishnavas, we have more stacked against us in terms of being able to switch off. So in 24 hours, we might spend an hour hearing Bhagavatam. We might spend an hour reading Bhagavatam or spiritual literature. We then spend a couple of hours chanting. Okay. Even if we do our 4 hours a day and you're resting for 6 to 8 hours, that leaves a lot of time to hear about a lot of other things, hear a lot about other sambandhas, other abhidhayas, and other prayojanas. Okay. So, what happens is when we're hearing all of these things, plus our previous conditioning, which really locks into all these other different things we're being exposed to, because it's cumulative. You know, this is how the mind is. You layer an impression on an impression on an impression and keep doing it. We believe what we hear, we believe what we see, and we forget who we are. And our whole process is actually really about hearing too much, should be too much stronger voices. The voice of Paramatma, Krishna, and hearing the voice of ourselves, the Atma. But if we ignore the fact that the mind is, especially, you know, as Rupa Goswami, as our Acharya for Abhideya, process of devotion service, explains that the mind is really essential to go from the stage of practice to spontaneous devotional service, to ecstatic devotional service, and then praying. If we really don't understand this point and live in such a way that we optimize moving the mind from being our enemy. And what do we mean by this enemy? We mean it is giving us all the perverted reflections of love. You know, we look at lust, envy, greed, illusion, anger, madness, pride. They're all actually manifestations of the opposite of love, which is fear. Right? They're all rooted in fear, the anxiety. I'm going to lose myself and I'm going to lose what I have. And when the mind is absorbed in all of these things, because the other sambandhas, abhidhyas, and prayojanas are completely feeding off those fears. They feed off pride. They feed off envy. They feed off anger. They feed off bewilderment, illusion, madness, and ultimately they feed off fear. You don't have this. You need this. You're not good enough if people don't see you like this, right? Even to the point where envy can even be glamorized, right? You look at books that we've read. You look at literature that we might have read as children, even as teenagers, movies we watched, the high school experience of, oh, wear that outfit. Everybody will be so jealous. Have this person in your life. Everybody else will be so jealous. Get these grades. Oh, your happiness is based on other people's misery. You know, I mean, we were having a discussion yesterday in one of our sanghas, and really having a unpacking of what the kind of things we're exposed to. And, you know, it's actually pretty amazing. If we look at a lot of the things we've watched since we were children, even in cartoons, and then teenage programs and adult programs and these different ratings that they have, what are the ratings related to? Right? All of these ratings are related to the degree of sex or violence that is contained in each of the programs. Again, the effortless peak of pleasure. Right? Because anger, violence gives you some sort of peak of pleasure. Right? So even those give you some sort of peak of pleasure. People will say when I feel angry and I'm able to express it, it feels good. Right? So, but if we actually walk past someone's window, and this is a crude image, so I don't want you to meditate on it, but if some of the things we watch and is very freely made available to children and adults on TV, on social media, if we were walking past someone's window and we saw those things happening, we would never stop and carry on watching. Not only would we never stop and carry on watching, especially if it's violence, we would probably alert someone and get help. But now we entertain ourselves with those things, convincing ourselves that it's not real, it's just pretend. But in the mind, it's real. And in the mind, it creates new sambandhas, new abhidhyas, and new prayojanas. Okay? And even if we don't watch sex and violence on TV, these things have their subtle forms in terms of control, in terms of envy, in terms of collection of material things, in terms of strengthening the I in this world, the validation, the experience. I am here. Okay, so whose voice should I hear? How can we turn up the volume on Paramatma? How can we turn up the volume on the Atma? And how is it that we turn down the volume on the mind? Okay, because first of all, we need to turn down the volume of the mind before we can even look at, right, I'm going to turn down the volume of the mind. Then I need to clear all this debris, all this collection of millions of lifetimes and millions of moments, even in this birth, millions of moments of experiences. And I also want to transform. I want to transform my mind into being that bridge, being that best friend that allows me, that allows the sound of Atma, that allows the voice of Paramatma, both externally as Guru and internally as Krishna, to come through. Right, we talk about intuition. How do we know the difference between intuition and Paramatma? You know, if you look at gut feeling and intuition as a sixth sense, intuition really is information that we've gathered from many places, experiences we've gathered from many places, and mainly across different time frames. And we've gathered it and come to a conclusion so quickly that it's bypassed the brain. Because like I said, you know, like we understand mana or mind is more than just the brain, right? It's not just local to the brain. So intuition is still quite a material thing, but it's still, I guess, closer to Krishna's voice, the inner voice, or has potential to be closer to that than the gross mind, the more gross thinking and feeling. And the reason I say potential is because this intuition's there to develop to various degrees in all sorts of human beings. And some people use this sixth sense to connect with the metaphysical world and with spirits and ghosts and other entities. Some people use their intuition in their work, their sixth sense in their work. When you've been doing something for a really long time, you can put things together without all the gross information being there in front of you or to hand, because it's just comes together, right? And bypasses your brain. You're not even quite sure how you got there. And then there's, when we're following this process of bhakti, our intuition, our ability to bring together our experiences and learning and information and feelings from many different moments in time and many different experiences, including our spiritual experiences, is possible because we're engaged in devotional service. So we are open to that. So this process that we're given of, you know, Prabhupada explains hearing, chanting the holy names, actually starts with chanting the holy names and hearing, which we include, you know, hearing and reading, associating with sadhus and guru. These things are what quieten the mind. Okay, because we are, first of all, the holy names quieten the mind. We understand is that just mantra, right? Frees the mind of busyness, frees the mind of the pulls of the enemies of the mind, and really helps the mind to just be calm and not busy all of the time. So our process, at the very least, you start chanting, the first thing people experience, even if they have no information about Sambandha, even if they have no information about Prayojana, even if the only thing they do is if a person picks up a bead bag and starts chanting, they will experience some quietening of the mind. But as you do it more regularly, it's important then to start understanding Sambandha and Prayojana, because what happens is, and particularly with the Mahamantra, Mahamantra is Krishna. He's not just here to give us a peaceful mind. His love is capable of doing so much more than that. The next thing is purifies or cleans the mind. Oh, now this means shaking things up. And shaking things up means feeling uncomfortable and seeing things about our conditioned self and about the world that we refuse to see before. And if we don't have information on Sambandhan Prayojana, then it becomes difficult to state with that, which is why, you know, we may propagate chanting kirtan or japa on the premise that it will make you peaceful and it will make you calm. But if we then don't take people onto the next stage of understanding the Sambandhan Prayojana side, then they will come to this cleaning and purification part of it, of their meditation, and that they may just put their bead bag down because they may be thinking, well, I came to this to have a peaceful mind and now my mind is agitated. I'm seeing things in myself and in the world that, hey, you know, these existential questions are coming. I have no answers. So there has to be a natural progression. We can't just stay at the whole, oh yes, the Maha Mantra is good for just quieting the mind. Because we all know, you know, if you're going to take to practicing it seriously, there's many times when your mind is not quiet when you're chanting. You know, there isn't always a feeling of, oh, this is so wonderful and peaceful. And then the next stage, transformation. Transformation in that, not only, oh, the first stage of transformation is everything we hear and we read and everything that's within us from Paramatma and Atma gives us, then we then start to practice. Okay, well, mind is giving me this enemy type dialogue. Let me transform that to friend dialogue. We do it actively. We practice. And as we practice, it's like changing a ship's direction, right? When you change, especially a big ship's direction, and it takes a small 1 degree shift, you can change the destination of that ship, right? So in these small shifts, these little practices of being scrutinizing with Shastra, being regularly introspective, being insightful and humble, we start to change it. And our mind starts to slowly turn more and more and more inwards. So much so that that bridge, that side of the bridge of the mind where we just can literally walk to the spiritual world using the mind, that transformative process where we no longer have to keep practicing Vaishnav achara and prachara, Vaishnav words, thoughts, and actions, becomes natural. And this transformation actually becomes a window. The mind becomes a window to the soul. Because actually spontaneous devotional service is first practiced in the mind. So when we are engaging in our activities of Krishna consciousness, if we are quietening, cleaning, and purifying the mind and then transforming it, then it is natural that the voice of Guru becomes louder, both outside and within. It is then natural that our own voice, our real voice, becomes louder. And then even if the world continues the way it's going now, or even worse, if things escalate even more to the point where, I don't know, we might even have, I think there was something I heard about glasses, maybe they've already come out, that actually your computer's inside your glasses, so when you can look through the glasses to see around you, and you also have, you can look inside the glasses and you have a screen in your glasses, soon I'm sure that'll change to something where they put it in your brain. I mean, things are just becoming more and more invasive. It doesn't matter even if things go that to that level. When our mind is on our side, when we are understanding Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojana, and our practice of it, our engagement with our real life is so strong that actually everything else around us doesn't then have that same pull. We can't wait for the world to become a peaceful place. We can't wait for the world to become conducive to Krishna consciousness for us to decide to go deeper. It just doesn't work like that. This is why Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said to Prabhupada, when Prabhupada said, hang on a minute, you want me to preach the West, but whoa, we're materially, you know, behind the West. They're in charge of what's going on in the world. We try and do what they do. Saraswati said, you can't wait for any material condition to change. The time is now. And this is a powerful thing, I think. You know, we have to, I think it's important to understand about Guru. Guru means heavy, okay? And when we read, when we hear, I'm pretty sure if any of you have been practicing for any amount of time, even a day, you may have come across some statement or something that you think, my God, that sounds really impolite, or that sounds really heavy or really offensive, or that kind of disturbs me. But think about it. When it's an emergency situation, do you stop to check your grammar? Do you stop to check the tone of your voice? When there is an emergency, you scream and shout and you use your most obnoxious voice to get people out. right? If there's a fire, we go, oh, please, everybody, the house is burning down. Please, very, can you please just leave? Very politely. Yeah, you're like, fire, get out. Okay? So when we hear Prabhupada, some of Prabhupada's statements, maybe even your own guru's statements, okay, that made my skin crawl, or that really, you know, pinched my ego. It's emergency. Okay. And I'm just looking at time, and I don't know where time always goes. But just coming back to Srila Prabhupada's purport, you know, we have this constant dialogue, I think, in ISKCON, how important is Varanashram? Right? Should we be putting effort into setting up Varanashram, or should we do what Prabhupada says here? Just chant Hare Krishna, read and hear, associate with devotees, listen to your guru, and everything will be fine. You will fulfill Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, and you will fall in love with Krishna again. And you will get your effortless peak of happiness, not just once, not just twice, but repeatedly and ever increasing for all of time. Okay. But he says the ideal setting for this to happen is Varanashram, right? That in this world we are engaged appropriately. And one of the challenges we have to setting up Varanashram is because we keep getting pulled by these outside influences. How many of us don't know what our career should be because we're influenced by the fact that we have to make money and we have to look a particular way and have particular things, when our actual Varna might not attract as much luxury? And actually, all the Varnas are not meant to be wealthy and rich and live in opulence and, you know, sleep on super king-sized beds. Okay, so it's, you know, an ashram as well. We get pulled left, right, and center. Oh, 50% divorce rate in society. Is it worth getting married? You know, even amongst devotees, I see the same thing. Is it worth getting married? Should we have children? If I don't have children, then I can do more service. You know, we take these outside influences. They get mixed up and we get confused. So all this mental noise makes it very hard for us to set up Varanashrams. That's why Prabhupada says, look, just start chanting. Start engaging in the process. And when your mind is clearer and you can hear the voice of Guru and Sadhu and Shastra properly, then Varanashram also becomes very easy to do, because we don't have this spiritual narcissism. Okay, everybody talks about narcissism. What is narcissism? I am what the world sees. And narcissism develops and more strongly where we have a very weak sense of who we are. Okay, so even in this world where we don't have a strong sense of who we are, then what the world sees of me is who I am. Okay, and as devotees, we have a type of spiritual narcissism where if other people think I'm a devotee, then I'm a devotee. But am I actually a devotee? Becomes quieter and quieter, right? And humility means, hang on, even if nobody recognizes I'm a devotee, am I becoming a devotee? So narcissism and humility are like opposite things, but it's very hard to be humble if we really aren't content and satisfied in who we are in this world. It's difficult, because if we're not, then even in our spiritual organization, we will constantly be chasing after, what do other people think of me? Do they think I'm a good devotee? Do they see me as a devotee? Okay, so, and it's very, very grounding. Anyway, you know, I just wanted to make a couple more points, and I don't think I'm going to be able to share the other things I wanted to share with you, but maybe I can cover them very briefly. You know, we talk about the, you know, just coming back to Sambandha, that ultimately Krishna, our relationship with Krishna, is the center of all other relationships. This understanding philosophically that the soul is Sat-Chit Anand, eternal, eternally blissful and wise. What is the mood that embodies eternal bliss and wisdom? It's Das Anudas. Powerful, isn't it? Lord Chaitanya, through his Trinadapi Sunichana verse, okay, he explains to us that actually the acid test, really, of when we are experiencing eternal bliss and wisdom is when it will lead to this natural, authentic sense of Das Anudas. Not practiced, it's There it's manifest. That is who we are. That is what brings us most pleasure. That is the effortless high of Krishna consciousness. And if it feels like an effort or if it doesn't give us a high, that means it's coming, you know, that experience is not coming yet from who we are. And coming back to this point about Varnashram, the reason Prabhupada again says chant first, because even if we get the Varna and the Ashram right, when it's separated from Krishna, it's ultimately not satisfying anyway. There are plenty of people in the world who are in the right job, who are in the right occupation, who are in the right ashram, and it will still give you the pangs and the pain from birth, death, and disease. Now, I was going to share three slides, but I won't. But the three slides were really just focusing on, just because I'm looking at time, and I know I want to hear from some of you, your comments, etc., and your realizations, or any corrections you might have. But what I wanted to share with you is, if we want to dive deeper into Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, you know, we have acharyas, we have a family, beginning right from the spiritual world, right, who are still with us here in this moment in time, that we can access, that we can have relationships with, that we can hear from. They're there to look after us, they're there to guide us, they're there to empower us. And each of them take responsibility for different aspects of devotional service. You know, we understand, like, Haridas Thakur is the Namacharya. He's in charge of helping us to understand how to chant in such a way that we attract Krishna, you know, that we become one with the holy name. So also Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, we also have our different acharyas. So if you want to understand more about Sambandha, the why of Krishna consciousness, our understanding why our relationship with Krishna is so important, the acharya is Sanatan Goswami. The presiding deity is his personal deity, Madan Mohan, who's now in, I believe, Karoli, in Rajasthan. And some of his writings are Hari Bhakti Vilas, Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Those of you who've read Brihad Bhagavatamrita, you'll see it's entirely about relationship. And Brihad Vaishnav Doshini. We then have our acharya for Abhideya is his brother, Rupa Goswami. And the presiding deity for the process of devotion service is Sri Govindji, who's also in Jaipur now. And we, you know, if we haven't, then we should all have read Nectar of Devotion. This is our handbook for Abhideya, the execution of devotional service. I mean, Prabhupada says in a lecture 1970 on the 27th of June, American date, right? Everyone should read this book, Nectar of Devotion, very attentively, because all the conclusive statements about the kingdom of bhakti are contained in this transcendentally valuable book. It is the essence of all Vedic scriptures, enlightening about Krishna consciousness. If anyone reads this Nectar of Devotion very carefully, you will have all guidance in the bhakti cult. So Rupa Goswami, he did many of his writings in Dhirgadamba, but when there's a samadhi of his there, but there's also samadhi of his in Radha Damodara temple. Very beautiful. And you can have darshan, you can sit and have his association, but mostly through reading his books. I mean, he's written many other books. And just because of time, then there's also Acharya for Prayojana is Raghunath Das Goswami. His books, writings include Stavavali, which actually includes Manashiksha and Vilap Kushamanjali, Mukta Charitandan, Kili Chintamani. These really focus on prema. Okay, very esoteric writings. And these three personalities spent 40 years in Vrindavan. 40 years in Vrindavan. Excavating sites of Krishna's pastimes, writing, and performing their internal bhajan, and preaching, and establishing temples and teaching others how to worship. And they actually left very similar time apart, and there's a whole other pastime about that, but we are short on time. But next time you're in Vrindavan Yatra, please take shelter of these deities and their respective personalities and acharyas. Because, you know, our real life of Krishna consciousness gives us so much more than anything else out there. And anything else that is out there, we are better able to utilize it and are enriched by it simply by being Krishna conscious. We don't have to cut ourselves off. But if we don't know how to use a knife, better to stay away from it until we know how to. So the outside world is like lots of sharp blades. But as we deepen our Krishna consciousness, we become expert in how to use those sharp blades in Krishna's service without getting hurt. Thank you very much for your time, and thank you for having your videos on so I can see a few of you, and for being so patient. Any comments, corrections, questions, please?
Thank you, Chintu Shakti Mataji. It was a very, very beautiful class. I feel very inspired. And so in the beginning, you mentioned how CC is the postgraduate study, how Prabhupada established in that way, because only those who are willing to accept our goal, our avideya, our process, will look at this and consider it as a possibility. Then you went on explaining how love for God only begins at prema and expands from there on. And you went with this very good perspective on the three brains, the physical brain, the emotional brain, the spiritual, heart, the three hearts, and how feelings and thoughts, they have their different spaces and methodologies of ways of working. And this love is blocked by lust, as Arjuna asked to Krishna in Srimad Bhagavad Gita. And then for a while you went on explaining our modern situation in regards to the media, how much our lives are being permeated by this invasive force, which is many times beyond our control and our grasp. And it influences our devotional service. It quickens our mind. It brings more sound. So you also speak a bit about how the mind needs to come down, and the chanting comes up, and how we share this with others. First, we share chanting as a means to calm the mind, but then we need to give them the process and the goal so that they then can then pursue on in the right direction. In this regards, I had a question that many times, and due to this exposure, we are confronted with many abideyas and prayojans, as you said, in our 12 hours of the day where we are not sleeping, chanting, hearing, or reading. We are confronted with our occupation, our friends, and so on. And so this pure bhakti becomes contaminated or tinged by all these abideyas and prayojans. So my question is, if you have any practical applications first, how can we prevent this contamination, this coloration from other abideyas, so we practice pure bhakti? How do we prevent it, and how do we draw boundaries? Similar question, so that we can practice just pure bhakti.
I mean, you've answered your question itself with the question, because boundaries are what helps us to prevent, right? And that's what we've lost. This is why I was making the point about we've lost those boundaries just because of the way digital media or any kind of entertainment or information is now, or work is now, disseminated. Okay, and now it's even normal for us to do everything on video, right? So the boundaries are harder to place, because you look at wireless and digital, it's ethereal, isn't it? It's in this ether. You can't see it, right? You can't see the workings. When we can see the workings, when you're in a room and there's a door, you know where the boundary is. Where there's walls, you know where the boundary is. It's clear. You can see it. You can feel a wall. But in the digital world, where's that wall? Where's the exit door? Where's the boundary? So the answer to your question is actually, as you've said, that we prevent getting influenced by so many different sambandhas, abideyas, and prayojanas by placing boundaries. And now it requires far more conscious effort, but our conscious effort needs to be applied differently. See, this is the thing with balance. Okay, we are all trying to create balance, but balance is dynamic. It has to constantly be recalibrated. Okay, because the world changes, and if the world doesn't change, we're changing. Our needs change. I mean, we change all the time. Our desires change. So our boundaries have to change. So now it requires, before, did people have to make a great effort to leave the office? No, they'd see a time on the clock. Time to go. Okay, now, so it's simple things, like just a very simple thing in the morning, rather than having a phone alarm clock, simple thing like having a mechanical alarm clock can make such a big difference because it's physical. And having your phone in another part of the building, you know, even in the ashram, maybe you guys can have a phone bucket or something, which is like hidden away, locked away, and you just cannot access your phone till after breakfast time, so that even you can honor your prasadam in peace. You know, at homes, we can do the same thing. You have your home bucket or digital devices, and you put them in and you park them away until 9 o'clock. And so you have that time and space in the morning to not be distracted. Same in the evening. And just a simple, that's a simple thing. And maybe you've heard that one before, but it's these simple things which carry so much power. You know, this boundary. When Krishna sees us putting boundaries in place, he helps us.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mohan Prabhu was asking, we, due to also this discomfort, like a flux of information that we have, and we cover ourselves with so many identities of what we are, so it becomes very difficult to understand how we are. So to establish Varnashram Dharma, it's very important to know what's our Dharma. So it becomes very difficult to even know where do I fit. So how can we establish Varnashram Dharma if individuals, if how can we help individuals to know who they are in this way? How can we establish Varnashram Dharma?
Really ideally, Varnashram Dharma, ideally executed, has to start in childhood. Because if we are missold ideas about who we are for the first 18 years of her life, and then we try and change things, it takes a long time. It can be really hard to discover who we are. So we have, because we have so many different things competing for our attention and our time, right? So in the long term, we need to start with our children now. Actually, any high quality organization or family or community invests a lot of time and energy in the children. Okay, and low quality organizations and communities don't invest any time in their children. They kind of leave the kids to raise themselves. So actually, Varnashram Dharma, both the Varna and the Ashram side, needs to really be beginning in childhood. For those of us who have not had the good fortune of having that looked at in our early years of life, as adults, I think it's important to remember that in terms of not our permanent occupation, we know what our permanent occupational duty is, our ultimate occupational duty is obviously to love Krishna and serve him and the devotees. But our dharma here, we have, again, it's something that's dynamic. Because first of all, we have many. It's not just one has, somebody has only one occupation here. Occupation has to go beyond meaning, because it's a very narrow-minded perspective to think occupation is what brings me money and what maintains me. Right? That's a very modern day materialistic concept, that our occupation or our nature, because Varna actually means nature. It's not just occupation, because our occupation is based on our nature, is that which we feel designed to do. It gives us pleasure. We have ability, we have talent, and we have training in it. So these things, there may be many. Some of those things may maintain us financially. Others may not maintain us. So for example, being a mother or a father, no money comes with that. Okay, but it may be part of your nature. Some people are very much inclined towards those services. That doesn't mean they're not doing their dharma. Okay, so it's a service. It's not just an ashram, right? So similarly, other jobs, occupations, there may be different things at different times in our life that we may be engaging in. Just because what you naturally did in your 20s, it may not be what you do in your 30s. You may be Brahmin by nature. You find yourself in a Vaishya occupation, but in that Vaishya occupation, you can develop a more advisory role, a teaching role. You see, so I think it is a challenge when we're older, but I think that's something we have to accept, because when you start to knit, when you start to create something, if the beginning steps are not taken, for example, like from childhood, you can pick up the pace, you can get the stitches in rhythm later on. just takes more effort. And it means you might still struggle with the beginning things. But like I said earlier, you know, even if we have our varna and ashram spot on, yes, we might have some good life here. That doesn't guarantee any Krishna consciousness. But I do think it's important to start it for our kids.
Thank you so much for sharing your insight on that. Okay, so time is running out. Unfortunately, we have to cut out some questions. I'm sorry to the participants. We'll ask a last question, which is in regards to how to practically differentiate between the words of the mind and those of the Paramatma, or to not get confused by these two.
Paramatma and Atma, so us and Krishna, we have one dialogue. Who can love? Can I love you better than you can love me? Okay, that's Anudas. Can I serve you better than you? This is the transcendental competition. So we can measure the mind's dialogue against this yardstick. Is what my mind is telling me going to deepen my bhakti? Is what my mind is telling me going to please Krishna? Is what my mind is telling me going to bring me closer to Guru, Krishna, and the Vaishnavas? And if it's not, then reject that idea, but transform it to something. So rejection is not complete. Rejection is just, I'm going to put you to the side, but it's still there. It'll still make noise, right? We have to reject, which means, okay, I don't accept you, so I'm going to transform you to something that actually is aligned with our, you know, or my true nature. And so another checking system is Guru Sadhu Shastra. That's the most simple. Check it out with devotees. If your mind's telling you things that you're not quite sure if this is Krishna's voice, if this is your real voice, or whether it's just your mind and chitter-chatter it's picked up from outside, because let's face it, a lot of our mind thoughts and feelings are not even our own. They've been placed there by others because we're connected to other people, the human wireless network of the mind. We pick up stuff all the time. We don't even realize it. We think it's our feeling. We're bombarded constantly. So we need Vaishnava relationships to give us some objectivity. You know, when we don't have relationships, and by relationships, I mean the type of relationships that are explained, you know, with the six loving exchanges, particularly where we are able to reveal our mind in confidence and hear from others. We're able to cook for each other and share prasadam. We're able to exchange gifts. When we don't have regular association like this with friends, fans, and heroes, then we become very isolated. And when we're isolated, the only thing we're left with, the only person we're left with is the mind, and then we lose objectivity. And our modern day society, that's both within and outside of ISKCON, has become very isolated. We've become more and more nuclear. Our families are smaller. Our friendship groups are smaller because of this mistrust that we have, you know? And also because those needs seem to be being fulfilled by all this vicarious living, watching others and watching other people's lives in so many different ways. And we also then see an increase then in people wanting to have a therapist or a psychiatrist or a psychologist, somebody I can talk to who will give me a non-judgmental space where they will hear me and be objective, because we need that objectivity. So if we have strong Vaishnava relationships, then we are better able to make use of Guru's instructions, and we are better able to hear the voice of Paramatma and Atma because we have objectivity. And we can then separate ourselves from the mind because we're not the mind. It doesn't matter how much we're convinced of that.
Thank you so much for being so objective with us. So I feel very enlivened. So I'm sure many others are as well. And that
you're always smiling anyway. That's good. You're always enlivened. Thank you for enlivening me.
So we'll sure have a very beautiful day where we can engage in service and devotional service in this way. Please, their lordships, please those around us, and make Krishna happy. Thank you so much, Mataji. I wish you a wonderful day.
Thank you.